Welcome back to the Hour of Timber and Building Supplies 1840 podcast. I'm your host, Paul Bullivant, and today we're going to be talking about artificial intelligence. So I'm delighted to have two guests with me. I've got Paul Cornford, who's the head of IS for Haworth Timber and Building Supplies, and Professor Alan Timothy, who's the CEO of Boo Boo AI. You'd be pleased to know you're the first professor we've ever had on here, so we're very humbled and appreciative of your time. Just in terms of introducing you both, Paul, I'm going to introduce you because this is the second time that you've been with us. Paul joined Haworth Timber back in May 1987. When there was just one computer in the entire company. With a background in engineering and a chance encounter with a recruitment consultant, Paul took a leap of faith into timber and has never looked back. This is according to AI, actually. I put this through ChatGPT.
It's probably fair.
So I don't know how it knows that you've never looked back, but that's what it says. Over nearly four decades, he's gone from manually installing hardware in branches with no power or networks to leading the digital transformation that underpins everything that we do today. From rolling out ERP systems to introducing email before even Google existed, Paul has seen it and driven it all.
And lived it.
And lived it, according to ChatGPT. He's now head of group IT and he's still pushing the business forward, preparing us for whatever comes next.
Hopefully.
So, before I introduce the professor, give us an interesting fact about your career.
Well, I've been in Haworth Timber since 1987, as you say, so most of my career has been Haworth Timber. So nothing directly with Haworth Timber, because you've summarised it quite nicely, or ChatGPT did. I, with Alan, have an interest in sport, okay. Although mine is not the same sport as Alan. For many years, I used to run an ice hockey club, our local ice hockey club. And
did you play?
No.
Watch
from the sidelines.
You need some padding for...
Yeah, you need an awful lot of padding. Yes.
Okay, that's good. Right, so over to you, Alan. Again, I've run this through ChatGPT.
Yeah.
Thought, with it being an AI episode, we'll use what's there. So, Alan, apparently, according to GPT, I'm not questioning this when I say apparently, you're a leading figure in the world of enterprise analytics and artificial intelligence. You're a professor of enterprise analytics at the University of Birmingham and a reader in computer science at Newcastle University. You're a serial tech entrepreneur with a career spanning 25 years and you founded multiple technology ventures across the UK and beyond. You're the founder and CEO of Boo Boo AI, a Gartner-recognised AI pricing company, helping businesses boost profits by up to 30%. Is he doing that with us?
Not quite, but we're heading there.
We're getting there, good. With a rare blend of academic depth and commercial experience, Alan's at the cutting edge of using data to drive smarter and more profitable decisions. Is that good from AI?
Yeah.
Excellent.
They've been on my personal site together, haven't they?
I'm embracing it. And I guess the same question for you. Tell us something interesting from your long and varied career.
So before AI, I was involved as commercial director of building the first football stadium in the UK since the war, Middlesbrough. The relocation from Ayresome Park to this brand new purpose-built all-seater stadium.
Crack, yeah, that's something to have on your CV.
Yes.
And that's quite different from AI.
It is. But it still had lots of data. You had no idea how many bums we had to measure to get the seat the right size.
Really?
No.
Yeah, that wasn't on ChatGPT that you were good at measuring bums for seats. But did you actually have to do something along those lines?
Yes, we did.
To work out the seat.
So there are two size seats in the stadium.
Right.
A posh size and a less than posh size. But there were several meetings over, including going to other football grounds to try the seats to see what sizes were the right size.
Amazing. So data is in everything that we do, isn't it?
Data is in everything.
Okay, so let's get on to the main content of today. So the background to this is we invited you to come and talk to our branch managers at our recent branch managers conference, and you gave us a really nice overview on AI, all different facets of it. The presentation went down so well.
Yeah.
Drove so much interest from people that we never imagined would show any interest in AI. Yeah. I was particularly interested in Martin Hughes and his view on fighter planes and pilots and whether AI could drive a fighter plane better than a human could. That showed great depth from Martin that I wasn't expecting. So today we're going to redo that here, hopefully. And I've asked you to cover four areas, which were the areas that you covered at our conference, which is where did AI come from and why is it so significant today? How we're all experiencing AI in our everyday lives.
Yep.
the impact of AI on business, and then the big question, what's next for AI? And is Skynet from Terminator round the corner coming for us? Are we good with that?
We're good with that.
Fantastic. Right. So let's start at the beginning. Where did AI come from?
Well, unlike Donald's view of life, it's a British invention.
Okay.
So it came from Bexley Park during the war to crack the German Enigma codes. So Alan Turing, and in fact a lot of the AI centres in the UK are called Turing centres after the man. So in the late 1940s, well, 1943, that was the birth of AI as we know it today.
Okay.
But lots of other things had to happen to get from that original experiment, which probably filled this room and several other rooms, down to what we now live and know as AI. It's British.
Was it called artificial intelligence way back then?
No, it's probably a much ruder word, but I might be old, but I'm not that old.
So where to after Alan Turing and Bletchley Park?
Yeah, and I've been there, and the original computer, the first one that was ever built, a version of it is still there.
Okay. And then what were the stages of development from there?
So there's two things that you need in AI. You need data, and you need the power to crunch the data. So just to give you the measure of the speed of growth in data, there's been more data created in the last 2 years than there has since the beginning of time. So that's the driver of the data. And if you put some measures on that, there's typically, per minute, 100,000 people on a Teams meeting. There's 44 million people on Facebook. There's 5.7 million Google searches and 167 million TikTok videos being played. So if you want to know where the data's coming from, never mind your phone calls or Alexa, the data is just coming at a huge rate. And to put that as a quantum, in the last 2 years, there's been 1 quintillion bytes of data, which, to put a reference to that, that's equating to all the grains of sand on all of the beaches in the world. So that's one part of it. To do this, you need lots and lots of data, which is the way the human mind works. You lots of things, remember it. So that we've got piles of data coming in, and you now need to figure out both what to do with it and the processing power to do it. So again, to give you some measures, so I started my first business in 1992 with a 12 megahertz chip. And I remember I bought an extra 20 megabyte drive for it for £1,000.
For 20 megabytes?
For 20 megabytes. And that was about as good as you got. I'm sure Paul can remember those days.
When we started, it was 10 megabytes.
Yeah. So
is that what our first computer had?
Our first computers had 10 megabytes in it. But it did mean that one of the expertise that developed was succinctness, because you just didn't have the storage for anything more.
Well, how could you store anything with either 10 or 20 megabytes? Because, I mean, nowadays your phone has, what, 120 gigabytes?
Your phone is more powerful than the computer they use to land the rocket on the moon.
Yeah, I've heard that before.
So back then there wasn't as much data, and people used it sparingly. I mean, I can remember pre-Excel days. So this growth is phenomenal. If you take the power of computing today, since 2000, the computer speed has risen 20,000 times.
These are all serious numbers, aren't they?
And it will go up again. So when we get into what's next, there's another wave of computing coming to do that. And I'll give you a business context, although we're not quite there yet. So when I started doing this pricing stuff, the company I was working for had 100,000 customers, 120,000 SKUs, 12 billion price points. And when we put it through a server, it took 145 days. So if you're doing pricing, that's just a tad too long to make it stick. So even between 2017 and today, so we can process that amount of data now in a couple of minutes. So you need the two things, because you've got all this data, you need to put it all through to standardize, normalize it, get rid of the chaff. So they're the two big drivers, is a growing computing power, as you said, in your phone, in just about everything you've got, and the growing amount of data that you can use to learn from, train the models from, are the two things that have really accelerated probably since 2000 or 2010 in particular. They've grown exponentially.
Where does all the data go? So there's all this data's produced from all kinds of places. Where does it go?
It goes into the cloud.
And that's where data farms, server farms come in?
Yeah.
Yeah? Can you explain what is it a data farm, server farm? What's the terminology?
Well, internally we use states of hardware, so we don't tend to put a lot of our commercial data out in the cloud. It's currently, we co-locate it, so it's stored in two separate locations.
But out there in the world with people like Google and all the yeah. big, where does all their data go? Into data farms?
Into data farms.
So from somebody who doesn't really have a clue, what is a data farm and how big are they and what would a data farm look like?
It's just a room full of computers.
Right.
But obviously to do that computer, and this brings on lots of very minor issues, you need lots of power.
Okay.
So you need lots of air conditioning. And by the time you're into the Microsoft and the Google sides, they'll have multiple power sources in there. They'll have multiple lines into there. They'll have generators. And they also use what used to be RAID 5. So they'll spread the data around so that if any one center fails, you haven't lost the data.
Okay.
So the difference partly between almost an industrial environment is you've got your server with your data on. By the time you get your cloud for TikTok or all, it's distributed into this huge storage centers around the world. And they're popping up at a fairly regular basis. They are football-sized pictures of
Full of computers.
Which brings the other big problem you've got. This is what do you do with all the heat?
And that's that is a serious problem. Heat generated from computers.
Yeah, I mean, I remember going back in time. The size of the computers were huge. I mean, I used to have a server room, probably four times bigger than this, raised floors, and all the rest of it. And now I can probably fit it in something the size of this table.
Right.
So there's less heat than there was, but there's been a growth in the number of them. So heat is a real issue of what do you do with it. My stepdaughter's doing a research project at Durham, looking to put the heat generated from the data centres at Durham into the old mines,
okay.
into the old mine workings, and then heat the water up there and then use the hot water or the heated water to then use.
So data could become a renewable heat source.
Yeah.
Amazing.
But it is a big problem. And the bigger we get, and when you start doing supercomputers, the heat just rises.
Exponentially.
But it's not stopping the growth. This is coming. This is arriving faster than you and I even know.
So all that data that's been produced in the last 2 years, more than in the rest of time, does it stay forever or does it ever get deleted?
That's a very interesting question.
It is a good question. Allegedly, it stays forever, which is something you should observe. If you put something on social media, it's not likely to get deleted. We look for it to stay forever. Immutable backups is one of our protections against cyber attacks. So we rely on it.
So all the data isn't in the same place, in the same readiness. So you've got layers of... So you've got the data where you pick up your phone, you get your list straight back up. But as data gets older, it tends to go into what the industry calls deep storage, the S drives, where it's static and it's in a much more efficient state. So some of the Amazon backups claim to be in deep storage, which are nuclear proof. Now, who'd want to resurrect the data after the bomb's gone off is a question I've not asked Jeff yet.
Well, here's my question linked to that. Come the apocalypse and the world no longer has electricity, how do we tap back into the knowledge that's no longer written in books and in things?
You don't.
Yeah.
I have a windy-up radio, and I think we'll be having windy-up chip detectors.
Power sources to run computers. That really could be a problem for humankind, though, in the future, couldn't it?
I mean, I think even from a commercial perspective, the potential loss of expertise within the business because you delegate that to AI is a potential dinosaur moment if we don't manage it properly.
Yeah, interesting. Right, let's move on.
Yes.
So let's go on to how we all see AI in our lives now. So we know of things like ChatGPT and Gemini and Copilot, but tell me more about the things.
The more obvious ones. So the average person today, the average home, will have 4 AI-powered devices.
Okay. Do tell.
So things like Alexa, Siri, if you get the recommendations on Netflix, that's AI. If you use Spotify or the Amazon version, that's using AI. If you drive an electric car like a Tesla, that's AI. If you've got the Google picture recognition on your phone, that's AI. So AI is slowly coming into people's lives, but they don't necessarily recognize. You don't get into Tesla and going, oh, I'm doing a bit of AI today.
AI. Yeah, okay.
It's just I'm driving it, but you will recognize a pedestrian, it'll drive without you, and that's all AI. So AI is here, big time, getting more, and even being used by most people now, if you do it writing. I don't know anybody who writes their own speeches anymore. I know fewer people who write their own emails anymore, and you can tell the difference. So it's out there and it's coming. So to give you the current measure, they reckon by 2030, which is only 5 years ago, the average home will have 20 AI-powered devices. So they'll start to get into, and you'll see it in what you're selling, the control of heating systems, the control of ventilation systems. So anything which you can automate based on a data feedback loop. So is the room hot? Is the room cold? What time do you normally get up? What time do you normally go to bed? The systems and the AI powered will start to take over all those parts of your life. So even, on Amazon, you've bought this. Why don't you buy this? Because you need... So it's slowly creeping in without people seeing it coming.
On the subject of its ability to write things for you, I was reading in the paper not long back about the problems that universities are having with students writing dissertations via it and the challenges in identifying what is AI written rather than personal driven. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, that's not really the problem. So yes, students are doing it, and I'm sure I would be doing it, is all papers now go through a detection system where the things like ChatGPT and the like can actually tell you what it's written, because it never forgets anything. So I don't think it's the use of the AI is the problem. It's when it is the only use of the AI it is the problem.
Okay. Yeah.
It is if you take that as a first piece of information and then you add to it and change it and context do it, then the question is how much change makes it yours?
Okay.
And is the question, not can I spot somebody who's cheating?
And have you a view on that? What percentage does need changing to make it yours?
I don't have a view on that. You'd need an academic to answer that question. but it's like if you write an email or you do something, because some of the big myths about AI that people don't understand is AI doesn't do context. So AI, if you take ChatGPT, and I can give you some well-known cases. So, for instance, lawyers have used ChatGPT to write a defence.
And used it
and submitted it. But, so ChatGPT is there to write the most perfect response it can.
Yep.
And it knows it has to put case law in, it knows it has to lay out. But if it can't find the right case law, it has been known to make it up. Because it knows it has to put case law reference in. So lawyers have put it in without checking it with made up case law. So it is very good, but in all AI, including the pricing and the things we do, is you need the human there because the AI doesn't do the context.
Yeah, okay.
It can tell you what theoretically the best written version of something is, but it doesn't know the context that you're going to use it in.
With the proliferation of AI type tools like ChatGPT, there are literally hundreds of them, aren't there? Are there any that you really rate and are good for everybody to use? Or
no, They all have some unique advantages. So I have a friend who's got an AI business in the States where I'm on the board, and he has had a new presentation, and he went to all the engines and got the engine, because it'll search your website,
okay,
and it'll write your presentation.
Yeah.
So we got four different engines, like ChatGPTs, to go and search his website and come up with the best presentation. And there wasn't a clear winner, but there were some good bits of them all he could put together.
Is that what he did then?
That's what he did.
He pieced them all together.
So we're having ongoing, when we have our board meetings, of how far have you got with this? And it was certainly much quicker than him doing it himself. But it wasn't... It missed some of the nuances that you do that.
If in that instance, if there are four engines broadly looking at the same potential content, why does it produce four different versions?
Well, first of all, content is probably not exactly the same.
Okay.
So that's the first point. The second one is, it is how you train them.
So that's the prompts that you write into, ask it to...
So what they have done on that data before they put it to you, because it doesn't know you want it, what a good letter to an MD looks like, or what a good CV looks like. It has to have examples of that. So it gets examples of, here is a good CV, here's a bad CV.
Okay.
So you train it, and then you keep playing it and playing it and playing it till it knows to be able to tell the difference. So I'll give you a medical example, is a better one. So AI has a great role to play in medicine of recognizing scan images and things like that.
Yep.
But the training data for the scan images is the doctor's first interpretation. So the doctor has to get it right first time. Otherwise, if you train the system on the wrong data, you get the same failure rate as you do with doctors.
Okay.
So there's a study gone, there's a particular rare cancer that's difficult to diagnose, and the doctor's hit rate was about 50%, and lo and behold, the AI is about 50%, because that's what you trained it on. So it's how you train the model in order to make the assumptions it's going to make, followed by your questions, is how you end up with the differences. And some of the big things in AI is bias. So, for instance, just talking about AI and recruiting, most people in technology are men.
Right.
That's just a numerical fact. So when you get a system and you go find, what's a good IT director look like, it is only looking at men.
Okay.
So when it goes and looks for the best IT director, it only looks for men, because it doesn't know.
It's not trained to recognize. It's not trained to recognize. Bias.
So you've got to put the bias in. Okay. So you've got to put bias training in that says the sample I've got is not perfect. It's the best that is.
Yeah.
But you need to also think about these are the things. Okay. So if you put poor quality training data in, you will get misassumptions out.
Yeah, okay.
And the misassumptions that comes out can become important. If you want to look at things that are worrying that space, it's probably less the written word. It is probably more the pictures.
Okay.
And we've all seen them on Facebook and TikTok. It's like, that can't be real. If it's not real, it probably isn't real.
Yeah.
Because you can tell the AI to merge images. It's just a piece of just pieces of data. And some of the AI imagery of stars saying things inappropriately or doing things inappropriately is a much harder thing to control. The written word hasn't got that level of shock, and hasn't got a level of that. So that's who owns the copyright and the brand names, and is a much more worrying area, I think, than the written word.
But I guess as it naturally progresses, and it's just going to get finessed and finessed and finessed over time, and get better and better and better.
Okay. Well, if you just have to think of your computer games. I remember when it was like that. And now I'm not allowed to play computer games anymore. I look at what my son's got on the latest PlayStations.
Yeah,
it's like watching the telly.
It's like watching TV.
It's like TV. The processing power, the data you've got there, it is just so much better.
Yeah, okay. So moving on then into the kind of area that really impacts Paul and I and AI and in business. What's your thoughts there?
So if you take the overall things... So 70% of people generally will use some AI in their lives.
Okay.
Only 20% of businesses today will use the AI. And I said it when we spoke at the conference. So you've got the builder and he's got his Tesla car and he drives out, you know, and he gets in and he says, Spotify, play my favourite list. And he's then doing the ChatGP to write his marketing spiel or do his email. And then he goes to a well-known retailer of screws. And I hope not. And he gets a little piece of paper and a little pencil and the book to go through to write the order on. Yeah. So there's a misunderstanding in business, I believe, that it's not applicable to us. But you have to understand that people in their consumer lives have got AI and all of this all around them. And the danger is when they turn up at a business environment, they're treated like Philistines and idiots. Yep. And so even last night, my wife was on some new downlighters and she's found some pictures in Home and Garden or something, and she circled it and put it into the search and it gave back all the retailers who've got that in. So you might have, you, why would I go to a lighting shop and have all of that? So there needs to be a better understanding, in particular on day one, of what the consumer's experience at home and what good looks like when they come into one of your branches or start to interact with you, because they've got all of that going on there and they'll just get frustrated.
Are you suggesting then that human interaction is going to be a thing of the past in business because of AI?
No, I think the human interaction has a role to play, but it's, you know, it's like before emails, where people go, oh God, nobody will send emails. Now you get hundreds a day, but I still talk to people and I send full people. There is a range of ways that people will interact depending on what they want to do and when and why. So business needs to recognise there's a range of things the people are doing. People in B2B space where I live go, oh, e-commerce will never catch on. So I've been involved with some doing pricing and stuff for e-commerce sites, and all of a sudden people are ordering at 3 o'clock in the morning because that's what they want to do. And it's about recognizing there's channels which are non-human interaction, but there's channels which are human interaction, where the human action comes in particular is, and you come to your branches and you go to the counter hands, and these are very knowledgeable people, and it's like, I'm doing this job and it's a bit like that, and he goes, oh yeah, I know what you need one of these, and the computer can't do that.
So
it's understanding what that range of interactions has to be.
Where do you think on that journey between traditionally it's all about people and pure AI at the other end, where's your feeling that businesses are on that journey? Are we behind the curve? Are we on the curve? Will it naturally happen to us?
No, because I think it's going to be winners and losers. You're naturally on it, and fairness to Nick, he's going, this is coming. I'm not quite sure exactly how, but I want to start to learn. And that's what businesses have to do. If I give them any advice today, is learn. Go and do something. Go and try it. It may not be right, but if you don't start that journey, you will be left behind.
Yeah.
So I think you have to start it and you have to learn. And if you don't, in the future,
it's going to come back and bite you.
It's going to come back and bite you, because catching up is very, very difficult.
How do you see our journey then, Paul?
Interesting and challenging, I think, in honesty, in equal measure. I think it's fair to say that although as a business we look for the benefits of AI in the longer term, currently we're well aware that context is everything, and that... you know, if there's no evidence in the data, you're not going to get that being presented back to you, which is the survivor bias that was just mentioned. So we've narrowed it down really to three areas. We have got generative AI projects on the go as well. But our predictive AI projects are things which we have expertise, because the business has been in business a long time, who can judge the outturn of the AI. And that's been our approach. Get the AI to do the analytics. Bubo, and then get the analytics back and the recommendations, and then cast a close scrutiny over them and do that with individuals who could make those decisions. So we've come to the conclusion currently that AI is a bit like an actor. It can read the script. It's very good at presenting the script, but it doesn't understand the context of what it's doing.
That's a good analogy.
And so to that end, some of what comes out of AI is really illuminating, and some of it, we put a question mark on it.
Yeah.
And in the jargon, that's a guardrail, which we then feed back to Alan's team. And then the next set of analytics considers that which tries to add some context to the decision making. I think, frankly, it's come a long way in the year or so we've been working with Bubo, but it's got an awful long way to go.
So we're looking at pricing, customer churn, so trying to predict when a customer might stop trading with you, and we're looking at add-on sales. You bought X, you might want to consider buying Y. Is there anything else we could be thinking about and looking at, Alan, once we've nailed these three?
Yeah, there's lots of things, not just all to do with me. The other one that I start and encourage people to look at is the management of long-tail items.
Okay.
So 20% of your stock will account for 70-80% of your revenue.
Yeah.
80% of your stock will be 20% of your revenue, be higher gross margin, because those items tend to be high gross margin.
Yep.
With the staff you've got, you look at the 20% and you ignore the 80%. So it's very easy to go out of stock or overstock. So unless you can have a 12, 16, 26-week look ahead against your stock level, particularly in times as they get tighter, your capital tied up in stock will be wrong and you'll miss opportunities.
Yeah.
So that's the bit of the world I live in. In some of the other bits, I think, coming on at a pace, some of which I've done, is email sentiment analysis.
Explain that.
Right. So you will get, particularly at a corporate level, lots of emails a day from customers, some placing orders, some complaining. So you generally, the current thing is, it comes in, I'll come in, I'll read it. So there are now scripts there that will read the email for you, take the sentiment from the email.
Okay.
It's a sales email, put it straight through the sales. It's a complaint, put it to the top of the pile. So I was a director of a managed service provider, 20 million turnover. Lots of emails, critical support desk with 40 people on, and that revolutionized the business. Because you knew there's a problem straight away, and it was dealt with straight away. It's an order. Let's just deal with it. So that you can do it on voice, you can do it on emails. So that makes the customer journey better, because they get a reaction, the speed that's appropriate to what they want, and it's more efficient for the business.
Is that available now then?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the cloud people like Amazon and Azure, the basic data set is free.
Okay.
You it's not a difficult to go from I'm not doing anything to doing something,
because
the basic tools, because people like Mike Azure and Amazon, Google want to democratize AI to a large extent, because like the apps on your iPhone, if everybody else isn't doing it, the market's not growing. So you can do those things straight away. I mean, I'll give you a non-business one. So I'm involved in a medical charity, and we've got a large European grant for that. And we're using Alexa to count the number of times somebody coughs. So knowing, how would you cough? And, I don't know, I cough a lot, cough a little. But it's a, how do you feel about it? It's not a quantitative measure. Well, if you've got Alexa or Siri or one of those in your house, why don't we just train it to count coughs?
And just as importantly, discount everything else.
Yeah, and it does. And don't record anything else, because you're only doing one thing. And coming back to the, in the business side, what's come on a lot and will come in a lot more very, very quickly, chatbots. So quite often I would rather go and do a chatbot, because usually if you're trying to phone a call center in particular, you're on hold, you're number 484, and it's just a nightmare. So on the chatbot, a good chatbot with the learnings that go with it can get you through those processes quicker, which is back to your old question earlier, is everybody out there will have a different need at a different time. And in the business world, we need to be there ready to give them the best experience, given not everybody's experience is the same.
So it's a classic case of adapt or die, isn't it? If as a business you sit back and don't start exploring.
Well, that's the view we've taken as a business. We need to get in on the ground floor, because initially there'll be competitive advantage to be had.
Yeah.
But eventually the playing field levels and everybody's got the capability in the same way as it was in rudimentary IT. I mean, I'm curious, do you believe everything the chatbot tells you in light of your own concerns over the accuracy of the AI?
Well, I don't, but I'm going to make that judgment.
Right.
But I don't believe everything the call centre person tells me either.
So you don't believe anybody, Alan?
Well, I do, but we all place reality on it. you know, does that make sense? Does that, you know, does that answer what I need to go? And just like people, you know, if you ever go on the call center, it's like your call will be recorded for, it's so they can listen to it, learn, and get better. And that's what the chatbot's doing. So it's all in the same.
So that when they say that, it's not actually, it's about getting a transcript so that AI can analyse the transcript to build the, to improve the chatbot. Interesting.
Yeah.
I always thought it was recorded so that if somebody ever wanted to go back to the conversation.
Well, sometimes it is, but it's less so these days.
It's mainly the transcript.
It's mainly the transcript because the transcript's getting better.
Okay. So we're starting to talk about the future now and what's going to come. So let's go on to that. Before we do, somebody asked you this question. It was either me or somebody at the conference asked you about, is AI going to take over? And you've got a really good mantra for that. Can you tell us it? So, I know I've been cryptic, but I want you to say it rather than me.
Yeah. No, I don't. AI in itself will not take over, but people who use AI will take over.
Fantastic.
Because the two things together of the context. Context is king. You talked about pricing. So I know for our price recommendations, generally we're hitting about an 85% acceptance across all our customer base, because that 15% is the things that people know about the customer. It's the boss's son. It's a large customer we're trying to get into. Local things have got nothing to do with the data, but it makes all the difference to the relationship and the sale. Yeah. And I can never deal with that, and I'll never be able to deal with that. So it's the two together. But coming back to the, you know, my other client with 100,000 customers, 120,000 SKUs, you know, Excel's got 16,384 columns. How is anybody supposed to make any sense out of that? So you get AI to do the heavy lifting, and then you get the humour to put the context on. As you said, you've got experts out there, and I was, yeah, no, I won't quite take that. But if he's not doing the heavy lifting, he can spend more time putting value on the context, because that's where the value is to your business.
Do you know, that line, I've used that line from you a lot about AI won't take over, but people with AI will a lot since you presented to us.
Yeah.
Do you want to just expand then a little bit more on where you see the future? So in the next 5 or 10 years, what developments are we going to see? If we've had more data in the last 2 years than in the rest of time, the whole concept of speed is now irrelevant. You know, what do you think will happen in 5, 10 years?
So we're about to go through the next big computer breakthrough. So almost we've had a data breakthrough, and the computers are now the limiting factor again. They're better than they were, but they're starting to become limiting. So there's the race on in the world to build supercomputers at affordable prices.
Okay.
And when you get the supercomputers, that's when you start to go to the next level of AI. So currently, all the AI is very specific AI. It's a chatbot. It's a pricing tool. It's a customer retention tool. It's a Spotify recommendation tool. There is not one tool does it all.
Okay.
It's a very focused thing. The more power you've got, the more you can start to combine things to do multiple things. Okay. And some things together in my little world, pricing and customer retention, whilst currently it's two tools, in reality, it probably should be one tool.
Because I guess that improves context.
It improves the context. You're adding more and betterness. But the computing power to do that currently starts to get chewy with bigger customers.
Okay.
So we have two tools. So the more powerful your supercomputer is, the more you can start to put things together and go to general AI as opposed to specific focused on AI. But I think even just in our current road, so some things that I don't quite understand, if you take the NHS and say scans. So currently they do human first and then AI. Why would I trust somebody to look at a picture for 8 hours a day after a hard night, the night before, and they're feeling cold? Why don't we get the AI to do it and then use the human to do context checking? So some things we're doing the wrong way around as people gain confidence and start to learn. And I think it will go more. The AI will become the first, like driverless cars. Having seen some of the idiots on the road, why do I think a driverless car is going to be a bad idea? So I think rather than AI being the second choice, the various incarnations of AI will become the first choice with the context of humans as the backup, not the other way around.
And the limiting factor to that development is computer.
Well, that's the technical bit. The other bit is the trust of the population and the politicians.
Okay.
Like the NHS could switch today, but nobody, it's all right to have a hospital where you're killing babies, but you can't trust the AI. So you there's got to be an attitude change that says we've got these great tools, we just need to embrace them. And yes, there may be the odd mistake, but doctors and people doing scans and radiographers are making mistakes every day, and we just don't talk about them because that's not nice, is it? So I think we need to start to switch that round to go, no, go machine. Like why does somebody, as you go through the airport and you get your bag scanned, why does somebody look at that? Why?
Yeah,
why?
Good point.
Well, the computer will be going chunk, chunk, chunk. It's more accurate, it doesn't get tired, it doesn't blink, and the bit like we're talking about the call centre, somebody reviews it and checks it at whatever number it is, just to make sure it's, and it learns and gets better and better, that you don't. We're not quite into the future, I've been doing a project with a golf manufacturer on return golf clubs. I'm not going to tell you who it is. It's American golf club maker. So when they either do a trade-in or there's unsold stock and it comes back and they've got to classify it, it takes them 5 weeks to train somebody in order to accurately identify the club and if there's a fault with it. And the average tenure in the job is 6 weeks. Why? Why don't you just stick it through optical recognition?
So it seems to me then the stumbling block is two things over development. It's people,
yeah,
who are still wanting to keep control of certain things that can be automated, and the power of computers.
Yes.
But both of those things to one side, how could you see us living with AI in 10 years' time?
So the other big elephant in the room that nobody really wants to talk about is the impact on people's jobs, their lives, and how we do with that. Now, it's reckoned that 10% of jobs will go.
Because of AI.
Because of AI. And you can see them. So as an auditor, why would I want to sit in somebody's office for 3 weeks looking at every seventh invoice in a file and a piece of paper? Who on earth thinks that's a good use of the auditor's time? Real or beneficial, when I don't know your computer system and your IT, your accounting system, but all my invoice electronic, all the receipts of things, we either scan it or comes in electronic, all the payments for electronics that I send out, all the payments so I only print it off to put in the file for the auditor.
Well, we don't print them off for the auditors, but yeah, that's a fair comment.
Yeah, so you can see some of the jobs are going to go. So if you take the unemployment figures we've got now and you put an extra 10% on there, there needs to be some scientific recognition of it's not their fault, it has changed, and we need to come up with a plan for it shortly. Otherwise, we will have a bunch of disgruntled people.
Okay.
So that's sort of one aspect. And then the next aspect is 40% of jobs will be impacted by AI, but not necessarily go. So that's a training thing. And we're not doing a lot of training in what this means, how it's coming, and how my job will change. Your job won't be worse, it will be different. So if you take pricing, the pricing manager used to spend weeks going Excel spreadsheets, and now he's going, the machine does that. Now, as Paul said, you're looking for the context, you're doing your value, you're doing the things that makes you unique, that brings the money. But it's a slightly different job. It's no less valuable, I would argue it's more valuable. And again, society needs to start to get its head around. So if you come back to the hospital, we will need radiographers. They will not go. They just won't be doing the first line scans anymore. They'll be doing the ones that are flagged as I don't know the difference. I can't do that. So there will be some big societal changes. And then if you come into the home, if we think Amazon's good or bad now at making the recommendations, how it starts to help us live a better life will become, some people will find that alienating and challenging, and some people embrace it, but it's certainly coming.
Yeah.
So, you know, so now looking at things like getting rid of keys and just having optical recognition, fingerprint recognition, you know, like you've got on your passport, to get through the door. Why do we want to have fobs around our neck and keys when you have a camera there and it goes, yeah, I know you are, let you in. So there's a whole technology conceptual change coming to the population that I'm not sure the population are generally ready for yet, because they don't see AI as AI. They see it as Spotify and Alexa and things like that.
Alan, that's been a very, very thought-provoking 40 minutes. I'm going to leave it there for now, because we could go on forever. But it's really clear to me that how you finished it's there. We all, everybody in business or at home, we just need to open our eyes and see what's out there for us to make our lives easier and better, because it's coming. Whether we want it or not, it's coming, and we need to embrace it and we need to evolve. Thank you so much for your time and sharing your experience. I really enjoyed it. Paul, thank you for being there and giving the Howard slant on things. To our viewers, thanks for joining us again. I hope you found it interesting. If you've enjoyed the podcast, it would be great if you could like and subscribe to any of our channels. And you could also recommend the podcast to anybody who you know, who you think might be interested. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for listening. And we'll see you again in the future. Thank you very much.
One, two, three.